we in this country have seen many new faces. People from all parts of the British Commonwealth and Empire and from the Allied nations.
These are among the last pictures to be taken in the capital of the Gold Coast. For when this day is over, Accra becomes the capital of Ghana, an independent nation within the Commonwealth.
Hello everybody and welcome to Hello from Britain, the Black British History Podcast, a podcast focusing on histories of Black British women in the 20th century. Welcome to the second of the July episode, Women and Pan-Africanism, Part 2. In Part 1 of this two-episode series, I took you through the evolution of Pan-African thought in early 20th century Britain, taking you through the many Pan-African conferences and congresses that came to dominate Pan-African praxis during that era. I also informed you about some of the women who were influential in developing Pan-African thought in early 20th century Britain, including Amy Ashwood Garvey, the first wife of Marcus Garvey, and African-American activist Ida Gibbs Hunt. The Pan-African organisers of that era shared a dream of achieving decolonisation, civil liberties and global unity for all Black people. In particular, at the last Pan-African Congress of that era, the 1945 Pan-African Congress in Manchester, it was declared that, quote, "We are determined to be free. We want education. We want the right to earn a decent living, the right to express our thoughts and emotions, to adopt and create forms of beauty. We are not ashamed to have been an age-long patient people. We continue willingly to sacrifice and strive, but we are unwilling to starve any longer while doing the world's drudgery in order to support by our poverty and ignorance a false aristocracy and a discredited imperialism." End quote. C.L.R. James, the famous 20th century Trinidadian writer and activist, later said for the 5th Pan-African Congress that at that time the, quote, "issue for the African world was the fact that we were not only subordinate in ideas and in actual life to Western society, but we didn't have much prospects of emerging from that subordinate position. We were waiting to go somewhere, but there was no policy or programme that was clearly set before us. It is important to know where you are going and to be aware of what you have left behind." End quote. On that note, it is worth highlighting that the 5th Pan-African Congress produced a memo to the United Nations Secretariat. In the memo, drafted by W.B. Du Bois, members of the Congress specifically asked for African representation in the United Nations so that the, quote, "grievances and demands of the Africans can be freely expressed." End quote. Interestingly, it appears that they were calling for either Afro-Caribbean or African-American representation of African peoples in the UN. As the memo explained that, quote, "American and West Indian citizens of Negro descent have already shown the world that they contribute to human progress." End quote. The memo said of Africans that they have, quote, "made far more progress in modern culture than they're usually given credit for and have a growing class of educated persons capable of expressing their desires." The production of this memo reflects a desire for the Western world to take notes of Black concerns, a desire which had been present since the first Pan-African conference in 1900, when delegates sent a memo to Queen Victoria. It also reflects W.B. Du Bois's ongoing advocacy at the UN on behalf of Black people. Earlier in 1945, he had wrote a letter to his American colleague going to a UN conference on international organisation, calling for them to speak up on behalf of all Black people everywhere. And later, in 1947, Du Bois produced a document for the UN on behalf of the NAACP, explaining in great detail how America had deprived African Americans of their rights. This document was entitled "An Appeal to the World." The 1945 Pan-African Congress was mostly administered by the Pan-African Federation, a group formed in 1944 that united many of the Black groups organising in Britain at the time. The aims of the Pan-African Federation were, 1, to promote the well-being and unity of African peoples and peoples of African descent throughout the world, 2, to demand self-determination and independence of African peoples and other subject races from the domination of powers claiming sovereignty and trusteeship over them, 3, to secure equality of civil rights for African peoples and the total abolition of all forms of racial discrimination, and 4, to strive to cooperate between African peoples and others who share our aspirations. Following the 1945 Pan-African Congress, the Pan-African Federation organised numerous protests against racism and imperialism in the UK, and even organised some international actions against oppression in South Africa and in support of labour strikes in Jamaica. They also produced a journal called, inventively, Pan-Africa, which had articles about racism and discrimination happening all over the world written by several international contributors, including Amy Jakes Garvey, the second wife of Marcus Garvey. Remember her? Amy Ashford Garvey's former close friend. Key figures in the Pan-African Federation included George Padmore, who was born Malcolm Nurse, T. Ras McKennan, who was born George Griffiths, Peter Abrahams, and Dorothy Pizer, who acted as a secretary for the organisation. By 1946, Padmore noted that Peter Abrahams and Dorothy Pizer were the people doing the most work for the organisation. Dorothy Pizer was a British woman of Jewish descent who, in the 1940s, practically became George Padmore's common law wife. Fluent in French and German, she was raised as the daughter of a tailor in London's East End. She grew up to be an accomplished typist, as well as a political activist who joined her brother in the 1930s to become a member of the British Communist Party. Pizer met Padmore while acting as a member of the British Communist Party. Although Padmore and Pizer never married, Pizer is said to have later changed her name by deed poll to Dorothy Padmore. Dorothy Pizer did a lot of work for Pan-African and Black organisation in Britain, but unfortunately is rarely noted in history books. Indeed, when a blue plaque was put up for George Padmore in London for a place where he used to live alongside Dorothy Pizer, Dorothy Pizer received no mention on this blue plaque. Of course, one could point to the fact that the blue plaque was set up by an organisation called Nubian Jack, an organisation set up to promote the contributions of Black and other ethnic minorities to British history. However, it is a shame that so few people in the history books mention Dorothy Pizer. Alongside Dorothy Pizer, or Dorothy Padmore, a white woman named Dina Stock was also involved with the Pan-African Federation, acting as an associate editor of the Pan-Africa Journal. Stock was close friends with Jomo Kenyatta, who would later become the first president of Kenya, and even helped him write his anthropological book, Facing Mount Kenya. McKennan, who worked closely with Stock on the Pan-Africa Journal, wrote of her that the movement did not think of her as a, quote, European, but as a person with all the characteristics of true greatness, end quote. As indicated in the last podcast and in this one, there were quite a few white women deeply involved with the Pan-African movement, causing the Ghanaian statesman Joe Appiah, the father of famous philosopher Kwame Anthony Appiah, to pay tribute in his memoir to the, quote, women of Britain, who we owe a special debt of gratitude for their clerical help, their comforting words of hope in times of frustration and despair, and, above all, their love and human affection so freely given, often in the face of opposition from families, friends, and workmates, end quote. While some Pan-African activists in the 20th century were separatists, there were many Black activists in 20th century Britain who believed strongly in cross-racial solidarity with both other non-white groups and white groups. Not for nothing, but many of the Black men involved in Pan-African organising at this time had romantic relationships with white women. By 1948, both Pan-Africa, the journal, and the Pan-African Federation had fallen into financial ruin, in part because of British colonial interference with their activities. In fact, the late 1940s and the early 1950s marked a slowing pace of Pan-African activism in Britain. However, the slowing pace of Pan-African activism did not mean that ideas from Pan-Africanism faded in British political consciousness. Most significantly, by 1957, Pan-African activists of the early 20th century had gotten at least part of their wish. A Black African country had finally become independent of British rule, Ghana, marking the beginning of widespread decolonisation in Black Africa. As we know now, decolonisation did not usher in full liberation for all Black people. Many newly independent countries in Africa and later the Caribbean had a lot of issues and, decades on, continue to have a lot of issues. This is part of the reason why some scholars heavily critique the Pan-African organisers of the early 20th century for appearing to suggest that independence in Africa would open utopia for black people. I tend to think that such critiques are a bit harsh, because when you live under domination, of course your picture of what freedom will look like will be much rosier than what freedom will actually be. Dreams are always shinier than reality. I also think that such critiques are a bit harsh because many organisers did in fact realise that decolonisation did not create utopia, and thus continue to organise to further black liberation. From the 3rd to 13th of June 1974 in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, the 6th Pan-African Congress took place, 29 years after the first one. This marked the beginning of Pan-African conferences starting to be held outside of the West. While this, the 6th Pan-African Congress, took place outside of Britain, activists from Britain played a part at the Congress, illustrating the continuing importance of Pan-African political thought to activists in Britain. For instance, CLR James, mentioned before, was one of the sponsors of this Congress. Recognising that decolonisation had yet to provide true liberation, he noted in a speech a year before the Congress that, quote, African people had been under slavery for some 200 or 300 years and then under colonialism for another 100 years. You don't get out of that and slip into a normal society in 10 years' time. The British did not allow an African state to develop. When they saw that the situation was ripe, they said to the French, well, they said, you come and rule and take over this government. And they sent the princess, or the princess royal, or the duke, or somebody with his little piece of paper, and he said, well, here is independence. Here is a wonderful new flag. They played God Save the King, and the new national anthem, and everything is new, and this fellow is in charge. But he is in charge of a British imperialist colonial government, which was constructed for British imperialist purposes, and not for the purpose of governing an African population. Black people are administering the old imperialistic government, the laws that they make, parliamentary procedure, that is what they are doing. And that is not working. They have to work out something of their own. End quote. Working things out is something that CLR James and the other sponsors of the Congress wanted to do. And that's why the organisers of the 6th Congress organised talks on famine, African unity, and how to provide political and material support for liberation movements. In the end, they resolved to push through what they called a Pan-African culture, a self-reliance culture that required, one, our schools to attach great importance to scientific and technical subjects, for the school must be an instrument in the service of the people, two, our educational programmes to make sure first and foremost that the child knows his locality, his nation, Africa, and finally the world. Three, our countries to oppose neo-colonialist and imperialist literature, which pours contempt on the people and their values. Four, the making of African languages, written languages, and media for expressing scientific thought. Five, the democratization of education by making it free and accessible. Six, the organization of adult education to arouse political awareness against all forms of domination. Seven, the granting of the Pan-African woman all her political and legal rights so that her emancipation may be ensured. Eight, all Pan-African states to review their educational systems to remove any neo-colonialist influence. Nine, our national languages to be the language of instruction in our universities to facilitate communication between our cadres and the Pan-African masses. 10, our techniques and traditional means of communication to be reviewed and modernised. 11, our traditional medicine to be modernised. 12, our languages, literary, philosophical and scientific works capable of accelerating our development to be translated. And 13, that the 25th of May shall be forever known as Pan-African Day. They wanted the 25th of May to be known as Pan-African Day because the 25th of May, 1963, is when, soon after independence in many African countries, the Organisation of African Unity was formed. If you want to find out more about the history of the Organisation of African Unity, I've left a link in the episode notes. The British people who helped develop these ideas about what a Pan-African culture should be included Ron Phillips, a Manchester-based activist who gave a speech at the conference on the situation of black people in Britain, as well as Ansel Wong, Zainab Abbas, and Gurlin Bean. Notably, this Congress, unlike the congresses and conferences of the early 20th century, included many working class delegates, such as Ron, Ansel, Zainab, and Gurlin, and carefully considered the role of the black working class in the Pan-African struggle, reflecting a sharp turn away from the early 20th century conferences and congresses where the voices of the black elite were prioritised. Now, if you have keen ears, you might recognise the names Zainab Abbas and Gurlin Bean. While Ansel Wong, a Trinidadian cultural and political activist, may be a new name to you, I did mention Zainab Abbas and Gurlin Bean in earlier podcasts. What I did not mention is that Zainab Abbas and Gurlin Bean, alongside Ansel Wong, were members of the Black Liberation Front, an organisation linked to the British Black Panther Party we talked about in episode 7. Formed in 1971, the Black Liberation Front, or the BLF, was a socialist and Pan-African organisation based in Britain which, up until 1993 when they disbanded, organised supplementary schools, affordable housing for young people, community bookshops, and published a newsletter called Grassroots. The Young Historians Project has produced a documentary and online exhibition about the BLF, which I've attached to the episode notes. The BLF fought against anti-black racism in Britain and abroad. Point 13 of their constitution stated that, quote, "As a revolutionary Pan-African organisation, we believe that the African people in Britain must break out of the idea of being an isolated community in Britain and build strong political, cultural and social links with other Africans throughout the world," end quote. Notably, for the BLF, black was often understood in a politically black sense with regard to people in Britain, but not so much for people abroad, where the primary focus was on black people in sub-Saharan Africa. Another notable thing about the BLF was that, unlike other high-profile black power organisations, they proclaimed an interest in women's rights from the outset. Each issue of Grassroots contained a women's column, which would often analyse the lives of black working-class women. Nevertheless, there were still issues with female representation in the BLF. While women dominated the membership, they were rarely found in leadership positions. Therefore, much like other black power organisations at the time, a separate BLF women's group formed to provide BLF women with a safe space to organise. Nonetheless, two women formed part of the BLF delegation who travelled to the 6th Pan-African Congress in Tanzania. Following the Congress, the BLF continued to expand their Pan-African work, organising school building projects in West Africa and a Pan-African Youth Exchange Scheme, which sent young people from the UK to Senegal, Nigeria, Ghana, Tanzania and Sierra Leone so that they might establish links there. The BLF also regularly celebrated the 25th of May as Africa Liberation Day. After the 6th Pan-African Congress in June 1974, there was the 7th Pan-African Congress from the 3rd to the 8th of April 1994 in Kampala, the last Pan-African Congress to take place in the 20th century. Resolution 16 of this Congress concerned asylum seekers in Britain, describing British immigration law as, quote, unjust and racist, end quote, thus indicating the continuing influence of black activists from Britain in the Pan-African movement. However, if you want to know more about the direct influence of Pan-Africanism on black activists in Britain, it is worth rewinding to 1993. From the 27th to the 29th of April 1993, Abuja, Nigeria, was host to the first Pan-African Conference on Reparations. This conference called for reparations for African enslavement, colonisation and neo-colonisation. Conference members published a proclamation which stated that the, quote, "damage sustained by the African peoples is not a thing of the past, but is painfully manifest in the damaged lives of contemporary Africans from Harlem to Harare, and in the damaged economies of the black world from Guinea to Guyana, from Somalia to Suriname," end quote. A prominent attendee at the first Pan-African Conference on Reparations was Bernie Grant, a man who, alongside Diane Abbott and Paul Boateng, became one of Britain's first black MPs in 1987. Following his attendance at the 1993 Pan-African Conference, Bernie Grant, MP, set about getting the conference to have a legacy and to make a permanent impact in Britain. Therefore, On the 10th of May 1993, he issued a motion welcoming the Abuja Proclamation, which was signed by 63 Labour MPs. He then created a UK-Africa reparations movement. The UK-Africa reparations movement had six main aims. 1. To use all lawful means to obtain reparations for the enslavement and colonisation of African people in Africa and in the African diaspora. 2. To use all lawful means to secure the return of African artefacts from whichever place they are currently held. 3. To seek an apology from Western governments for the enslavement and colonisation of African people. 4. To campaign for an acknowledgement of the contribution of African people to world history and civilization. 5. To campaign for an accurate portrayal of African history and thus restore dignity and self-respect to African people. And 6. To educate and inform African youth on the continent and in the diaspora about the great African cultures, languages and civilizations. The management committee of the UK Africa Reparations Movement consisted of Bernie Grant, who was the chair, followed by Linda Bellows, Professor Stephen Small, Patrick Wilmot, Sam Walker, Sally Murray-Jones and Hugh Oxley. Of the organisers, it is perhaps most crucial to highlight Linda Bellows, who formed a part of other organisations we have looked at in other episodes of this podcast, such as the Women's Liberation Movement. Linda Bellows was born Linda Adebowale to a Polish mother and Nigerian dad in London, 1950. She became one of London's first black female councillors, and in the 1980s, alongside Ansel Wong, Akiaba, Adai Sebo, and other members of the Greater London Council, facilitated the recognition of October as UK Black History Month. The first Black History Month celebration in the UK was organised in 1987 by Bellows, and Sally Mugabe was a guest of honour. At that time, Sally Mugabe's husband Robert was thought to be a positive figure by some black people. On bringing Black History Month to the UK, Bellows explained that the, quote, reason we wanted Black History Month was for British society to understand the importance and the relevance of black history in Britain's own history. That was the point. It still is. There is need for it. It's not just about us celebrating, end quote. She also explained that she's disappointed in the fact that, quote, Black History Month is becoming any manner of rubbish which had a hint or tint of spice, as opposed to what it should have been doing, which is uncovering history and showing that history, end quote. Today, Linda Bellows is a diversity consultant who specialises in LGBT equality. A major event that the UK reparations movement organised was the Birmingham Conference on Reparations. This conference, which took place on the 11th of December 1993 and was sponsored by the Voice newspaper, attracted a sizeable crowd which agreed that reparations for enslavement, colonialism and neocolonialism were necessary. As examples of enslavement, colonialism and neocolonialism, they pointed to issues such as debt bondage, cultural imperialism, environmental damage, the destruction of the African family and the gross media misrepresentation of Africa and its peoples. In other words, they pointed to issues that they argued continue to present physical, economic and psychological harm to black people. They also pointed to racist killings of black people and black deaths in police custody as examples of the continuing devaluation of African lives, mentioning by name Roland Adams, Stephen Lawrence, Joy Gardner, Cynthia Jarrett and Omasase Lumumba. Aside from this conference, other actions which the UK Africa Reparations Movement took included issuing a repossession notice to the director of the British Museum, saying that under the authority of the Oba of Benin, the museum director should return a mask and all other bronze and ivory objects from the West African Kingdom of Benin that had been looted in a British punitive expedition in 1897. The Africa Reparations Movement eventually fell into decline, no doubt due to Bernie Grant's untimely death in the year 2000. However, regardless of its short organisational life, its existence forms a solid reminder that, even towards the very end of the 20th century, Pan-African sentiment never disappeared in Britain. With that then, we come to the end of this two-part series on women and Pan-Africanism. In this, the second episode of the series, we explored how Pan-African thought developed in late 20th century Britain and considered the role of women in that development. We discussed how, despite African independence arriving in the middle of the 20th century, Pan-African sentiment was a continuing presence in Britain. We also discussed how women were sometimes given short shrift within the Pan-African movement, perhaps further evidenced by the fact that in this very episode, more men have been referenced than women, reflecting the fact that many primary and secondary sources on this history continue to almost exclusively refer to men. Pan-Africanism, therefore, is clearly not a framework that can cover every intersectional aspect of Black identity. As I noted in episode 1, Pan-Africanism is simply a, quote, belief in the unity, common history, and common purpose of the peoples of Africa and the African diaspora, and the notion that their destinies are interconnected, end quote. However, despite the fact that Pan-Africanism is quite a loose framework that cannot resolve all issues that Black people face, the Pan-Africanist way of viewing the world is still worth thinking about, especially as many Black women in 20th century Britain, and indeed many Black women today, articulated a strong ambition for all Black people across the world to stand together in solidarity against shared oppression. Now, let me leave you with a small anecdote, as is customary for this podcast. Following the decolonisation of several African countries in 1960, several newly independent African countries pushed forward a declaration in the General Assembly of the United Nations entitled Declaration on the Granting of Independence to Colonial Countries and Peoples. The declaration stated that colonisation was a, quote, denial of fundamental human rights, end quote. It argued that all people should have a right to self-determination, that, quote, inadequacy of political, economic, social or educational preparedness should never serve as a pretext for delaying independence, end quote, that, quote, all repressive measures against dependent peoples shall cease in order to enable them to exercise their right to complete independence, end quote, that immediate steps should be taken to grant independence to territories that have not yet been granted independence, that no attempts should be made to partially or totally disrupt the, quote, national unit and territorial integrity of a country, end quote, and that all states should, quote, observe faithfully and strictly the provisions of the Charter of the United Nations, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and the present declaration, end quote. This declaration was passed by the United Nations in 1960. Do you think that United Nations member states have followed it?